Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Good day, good evening, and good screaming. I am Jello Biafra, and this is Renegade Roundtable. And now, part two, the sequel, which is basically the sequel of the prequel to world domination and riding around in a bus like a Mongol horde as Gogol Bordello. And here we go again. Here is Eugene Hoots.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I guess I'm snipping out a little bit, but somehow from those early days and kind of following VV around, like kind of like I did Colorado's first punk band called The Ravers, who eventually moved to New York and changed their name to The Nails and had that radio hit 88 Lines about 44 women, among other things. But somehow you left Kiev and wound up eventually in New York.
Yeah.
Or did you form Gogol Bordello in Europe?
No, it's a very New York creation. And in fact, it was already my third band in the States.
Ah. What were the first two?
So it's very logical that I arrived in 1990, right when, you know, New York hardcore was just absolutely, especially just kind of going through it was very vital. I mean, there was just, you know, there was bands like Shelter and, Biohazard and Madball and Murphy's Law. And so that was the kind of, and I saw Fugazi pretty much right away as soon as I appeared on the East Coast. So, you know, all of that was like...
Did you see the False Prophets?
What's that?
Did you see the False Prophets?
No, I did not see False Prophets.
Oh, well.
But, you know...
Yeah, you would have dug them.
You know, all that music was coming as an avalanche. And, I mean, I thought that I was kind of very polyglottic about music, which I was. Like, I thought that I kind of more or less got a pretty good picture of it. And by the time I got to the States, like, you know, I knew about, you know, Birthday Party. And that was, like, my favorite band at the time, Sonic Youth. And... you know, who also played in Kiev once and were, I caught them there when I was 16 already. Right before I left, I saw Sonic Youth. So that was like a big influence, you know. And, but yeah, I was well aware, like the Gang of Four and all the kind of like a funky, more post-punk things. I was really into all of that already. But when I saw hardcore shows and how charismatic the people are in that scene, you know, it kind of blew my mind, and I kind of forgot all about, you know, David Bowie and all that kind of thing. Like, it just became irrelevant to me, like, you know, because, like, to a certain extent, all those things went hand to hand, like, you know, David Bowie and Joy Division and Devo and kind of, you know, you kind of, Sex Pistols and The Clash, you can kind of hear it all together in a certain, you know, in a certain polyglottic mood. But when I started going to hardcore shows in this teen center in Vermont, where I was originally brought, you know, I was 16, 17, 18, 19, you know, 20. I basically grew up, well, attempted to grow up again there for the second time.
Came of age.
Yeah, and it kind of blew my mind because I've never heard about them and about any of these bands. Like, somehow, neither Gorilla Biscuits or Fugazi, like, we did not get those tapes. We did not get, like, that music didn't go all the way to Eastern Europe. And when I started experiencing the live ritual of it, just completely, I was like, okay, this is it. Like, this is how you do it.
How did you wind up in Vermont?
Well, that was more of a doing of, you know, refugee resettlement program.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, we came to New York, but they booted us out of here quickly because I think it was just so packed with immigrants here that they couldn't, like, our sponsor, basically, Health and Immigration, was in Vermont. And that's how.
So your whole family came over at once?
Yeah, just me and, you know, my mother, my father, and me, basically.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, most of our older brothers and sisters and, you know, all my cousins are back there, you know.
Uh-huh.
But you see, like, that was a very kind of distinctly new era. And it was, you know, I mean, I was pretty, let's not get it twisted. Immigration is super traumatic. It's, you're depressed and you're trying to reattune and, you know, a lot of things that you like about life are just gone, you know, like, you know, your friends and your girlfriend and like all of that, you just gets left behind and you start on a clean slate without knowing the language. So to the credit, and I accredit this to particularly to punk culture once again, because to the credit of punk culture, you know, you can go from punk scene in Ukraine to punk scene on East Coast in America and make and join the community pretty much seamlessly. And
so were your first two bands hardcore bands?
Yes, Epitaph are our first band that I joined because these guys already basically were a band. Yes, it was we had a 7-inch and a tape out. I still have several of them. It was very much a kind of more thrash crossover band. Kind of along the lines
of... I didn't catch the name. The sound got garbled.
Epitaph.
Oh, Epitaph, like Epitaph Records.
Yeah, like okay. Epitaph Records, just the band Epitaph. And we, it was pretty much kind of a leeway, maybe a little bit of Biohazard, a little bit of Fugazi sounding band. We were trying to find a voice out of all those elements, you know. And I loved it, you know. It was exactly the sound of the moment. You know, it was just like, things were just blowing my mind like every week, you know what I mean? Like, here I saw Fugazi, then like, next week I saw Shelter. And you know, I was like, wow, like, what's that? Like, Hare Krishna hardcore now? Like, that's what's up? All right, let's check it out, you know? You feel me? I mean, that's so mind-blowingly progressive. Like, Hare Krishna hardcore, and not just a gimmick. Like, we have like a lifestyle, and the dudes who are just like Ray Kappa that's full on a mission, and you know, all the books and, you know, table with t-shirts and records and Hare Krishna literature, you know. Uh-huh. And I did not become a Hare Krishna practitioner, but I appreciate the stance, you know, I appreciate that these people were serious and there was a lot of vitality about it, you know.
Is Kappo still a Hare Krishna or did he move on to another phase?
I'm not sure if he's so devoted to the particularly Hare Krishna, but I know that he's devoted to the path. In fact, a friend of mine, well, Walter Schreifels from Gorilla Biscuits and Quicksand and Youth of Today, I know they're going all to India at the end of this month to pursue the practice, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And what was your second band? Yet another one after that.
Yes, the second band was already a band that I decided to form because I kind of wanted to make a mix of punk, which I loved, like, you know, Stiff Little Fingers kind of punk, and hardcore. So that band called The Fags. And we went on, originally called that, then we changed the name to The Cossacks in a late incarnation. And
The which?
The Cossacks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that was a, you know, I formed it with a guy, with Dana Shepherd, who you met on San Francisco show. That was a drummer, very tall guy with tattoos. And yeah, Dana was, I really hit it off with him in Vermont because he was also an immigrant. He was from Newfoundland. And
I just lost his sound. He was from where?
Newfoundland.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a hard land, you know, to come from. And he, you know, he was coming from a family with a lot of brothers, six brothers, who were all into punk and metal and hardcore. Like all, he was the youngest one and all his brothers were just like, Sheer Terror, you know, Motorhead, you know, DOA, DRI, like that was the family, you know. And it was just kind of like inspiring that, you know, I kind of fell into a pocket with like a dynasty of punk rockers. And we created a band and pretty much raised hell for next 4 years that we were there. Yeah.
So did you release any vinyl or CDs or cassettes or anything too?
Yeah, we had a one CD, second one never came out, but we did start making, you know, some impact. We played in CBGBs. We came out to play in, we started getting invited to play in New York City and Coney Island High was a great place. You know, that we played two shows there. In fact, first time we drove to play, Coney Island High, you know, it's like, wow, legendary place, you know, all we know about it is that, you know, like, Matt Ball is playing there all the time, and, you know, it's just a, it's like a mecca of punk and hardcore. So we drove there, I think it was like 94 or maybe 95, start unloading, and our bass player, Jason, goes, man, that's Joey Ramone and Tim Armstrong standing right there. So I was like, wow, what the fuck? Like, our first gig in the city and like two central guys are right here to check us out. I was like, okay, it's too good to be true. So anyway, we start loading, sitting up. Then, of course, it then turns out that the queers were playing downstairs in the bigger room, and Joey and Tim came to see them. So they all, as soon as the queers start playing downstairs, everybody disappeared from our floor and went to see another band. We played for like five people. But,
oh, boy. You called yourself the Cossacks. Was any of, I don't want to say Cossack music necessarily, but was any of the blending of the cultural and ethnic music and punk that BV did, was that starting to creep in with the Cossacks or not?
Absolutely. Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, a lot. And we had accordion in the Cossacks. And in fact, it was very proto Gogol Bordello. It was very prototype of Gogol Bordello in a lot of ways. Still had a bit of metallic edge because I played electric, right. And you know, it was just all over the place from like, you know, all my influences, and it had a lot of crunch in it. But I took, in fact, some of the songs from the Cossacks into Gogol Bordello. I mean, they were on the first, and even elements of them kept resurfacing for like first several albums, you know.
And is it the first album of Gogol Bordello that's titled Gypsy Punk?
No, that's already our third album. Actually, it's fourth album.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you did some before you were ever on Side One Dummy at all, then, that people like me have never seen.
Yes, that was basically when Side One Dummy, we joined forces with them, which, you know, endless respect. They were always awesome. That just was like a great, great era and great run. You know, I felt like we were really joining forces with a kind of good punk familia that kind of knows how to get shit done too, you know?
Right, right.
But that was already our third album. Well, two and a half, two albums and one EP. We already all that. Uh-huh. We had already, since 1999, we were releasing records. They were just on a much smaller label, what called Rubric Records.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was like a very New York.
I don't think I ever saw those. You identify Gypsy yourself, don't you?
Well, my mother, yeah. We have, in our family, we have Romani blood for sure. I mean, without it, I would never even explore, you know, I would be disconnected from the topic. I would have no...
Yeah.
I would have no in with the culture. It's very onto itself.
That music is part of what crept into Gogol Bordello too, didn't it?
You know, things coincided that, you know, I knew gypsy music. It was kind of like my parallel to go-to thing because it's just so kind of, you know, mind bending and swashbuckling, you know.
Festive.
Yeah. And especially like Eastern, especially like Carpathian and Romanian gypsy music in particular, which is, you know, shared the Carpathian Ukrainian west side, and that shares a lot of same energies, talking about mystical one more time. That is mind-blowing. So as a DJ, when I started bringing that up in my sets, you know, when I start DJing in New York City, you know, trying to make ends meet and or just for kicks, I kind of start putting in like Taraf de Haiduks and, you know, Fanfara Ciocărlia, these Romanian gypsy bands that were my favorite at the time, and some Django Reinhardt and other more sped up, more rowdy sounding gypsy manouche guitar players, you know. I was into that kind of like, it wasn't something that I could ever possibly play because it requires virtuosity, you know. You know, I was just always like kind of pretty, you know, punky in my technique. So I loved it as a kind of parallel passion. But in New York, I kind of got obsessed with that idea that maybe I can actually meet players that are virtuoso and kind of put them in a punk rock hardcore context. And maybe some things can be done here that were not explored. And that was became kind of the vision, you know?
Right.
And so that's why people, you know, Sergei, our violin player, and Yuri, is amazing accordion player. He was already a second accordion player, actually. The original accordion player was Sasha Kazachkov. He was quite great, more folklorically sounding. But they all had an important influence in, like, kind of crystallizing gypsy punk. Like, without him, it could not be, because that executing the rapid fire arpeggios on the top of, you know, it's not something I could ever afford.
Right. Right. Now, I wish more people would blend stuff they grew up on like that, and not just the same old punk or metal or whatever. There was one band from the DDR, I think they were called Deskeptiker, who had a very odd 7-inch EP, maybe even before Deserter, I don't know, with all these blues slide guitar in it. They didn't sound like anybody else. And wow. Then the wall falls, and suddenly they were, I believe it was them, maybe even Feeling B, who of course spawned the singer for Rammstein and whatnot. Wow. Soon as the West German punk sound came in, there was no more East German punk sound anymore. Whatever they did by accident that I thought was so cool and unique wasn't there anymore. And of course, VV moved to France, and I have one CD of them. After they moved, I don't know if they made any more or not, but already you could tell that, you know, Western European rock or whatever is starting to creep in more.
Well, you have to consider, I mean, first of all, it's amazing. You're blowing my mind once again. You're, as always, digging deeper than deep. And these are like extremely obscure examples. I mean, I thought I know quite a bit about DDR rock, but I've never heard about that before. That band. But you have to understand that technology, you know, it was always had a lot to do with why American music was so powerful. So the sound that people were thriving for, they were thriving to achieve that greatness. They, for them, moving towards that kind of more glossy sound was a right way to go. You know, as here, you're trying to break away from it and kind of get out of the Apollonian side back into the Dionysian. They're like so deeply in Dionysian, they're trying to bring some elements of, you know, technological finesse to it. So it wasn't a bad thing for in their eyes.
Yeah, I mean, even the very early Italian hardcore and Brazilian hardcore in its own ways recorded so weirdly compared to British or American. I was like, it had a charm all its own. I mean, the very first Ratos de Parau album in Brazil, guitar sounds like an electric razor or something.
Right.
And even it was the last Electric Razor record out of Brazil before they got a grip on the technology or got into bigger studios. I don't know. And then, but even some bands over here, sometimes their most interesting periods are right before they have a full grip on what it is exactly they're trying to do. I mean, even as great as they were straight out of the gate, Butthole Surfers and Hooster Du, some of the most interesting stuff is before they fully had command of what fine down home to a fine point of exactly what part of their sound they wanted to pursue.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I can see that. I mean, Bad Brands, I mean, recorded in Bodega right here on Avenue A, you know, that is just mind-blowing. It's unreplicable, you know, and it's ferocious. And that's, of course, because it's just people are in, it's cathartic. It's like they're not interested in technology at that moment. So that's why we become collectors of these things, because they are really they're real treasures. If not in a once in a lifetime, but this is kind of why, this is why I really, now that we have all this perspective of some time on history of, you know, punk and hardcore and all experimental music, it's kind of, for me, it's kind of becomes, the cream of the crop of it is becoming more interesting because the factors that brought it together are no longer exist. You know, people just have completely different agenda for life.
Right.
And it's beyond being collectible items. It's like a, and it's like a recipe. It's like a rare recipe that you need to collect and preserve, so some future master can find it and, you know, and do something with it.
I mean, as part of what did it over here, I think, was just like in Kyiv, only maybe a little bit larger scale. Even a place like San Francisco, 77, 78, into 79, the scene was very small compared to what people think it was, and thus the peer pressure was not for every band to sound the same, but for every band, no two bands can sound the same at all, or nobody's going to be interested.
Right.
Especially when almost the entire audience is people from the other band, all trying to do and find their own thing to blow the minds of their peers and impress them. Yeah, I can come up with something really cool too. And when hardcore hit, that kind of changed. But and because the audience was younger, it was more macho, and they wanted a certain thing. They didn't want other things. I don't know. But there were still always unique things coming out, including, of course, Gogol Bordello. But then we get to what is soon going to be the one-year anniversary of Putin's ongoing attempt to basically wipe out and occupy Ukraine. And within a day or two, I think, we were all very, just as individual people, who are just very shook up by the whole thing, the scenes of what was going on, even somebody clutching his cat in a train station because that was all he had left. And, you know, this is happening to real people right now. And it's not like what Putin did in Chechnya or in Syria where we didn't see it. This is what war, when war crimes, which is what war is basically, looks like. And so I sent you a little text message at first, feeling not wanting to bug you or anything. You must have been getting from all over the place.
Oh, I appreciate that. I mean,
right away, thanking me, saying that I was one of the first people who ever even asked how you were doing or anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, it's going to take years to process all of that experience. Like every day in the morning when I wake up, you know, like I'm still trying to reconcile that with my consciousness that this is what's actually happening. And like your first things, you know, before like you, you know, wash your face, you check messages from your family and friends back in Ukraine that, you know, they're holding up all right because there's ongoing communication. So lifestyle kind of changed quite a bit at this whole time. And there's a mantra going on all the time. It's just, you know, all Ukrainians worldwide and whoever is with us are fighting that war. And that's the frame of mind. It's for a second, it doesn't go away. It's just, however, what, you know, I really appreciated you reaching out at that time, which was once again emblematic of how people in a community of punk rock are, you know. I found it to be very inspiring, actually. Inspiring is not really a word to use because it's war, because of the tragical trigger of it all, the war. But I thought it was very, significant that the first people to react to the whole situation, artists, the artists who spoke about it and were, or to reach out to me or speak on the cause, were Patti Smith, guys from Sick of It All, and you. That, you know, the Gogol Bordello collaborated, the track that we created together, actually, Monty just added the guitar to it, so it's cooked now. It's gonna come out soon.
Oh, so it still hasn't been released anywhere, but it's coming.
It's coming, but it's for a particular campaign and event for
Right. Right.
Yeah, that's like, it has a purpose. So, and Monty was just the most perfect call as a guitar player for that, after all, you know. And
Monty is who?
From Ministry.
That Monty.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Monty Pittman.
Yeah. He was used to in Prong.
I didn't know he was ever in Prong. I know he also plays with Madonna. And
yes, that's actually how we met. Madonna.
He's in Ministry instead.
Yes. It's so kind of swashbuckling that we actually met at the concert with Madonna, but he was, before that, he was in Prong, and now you're in Ministry, and, you know, clearly we're in this camp, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's a fantastic musician, and his guitar is just absolutely killer on that track. But, you know, that was very significant that, you know, Patti Smith right away was very supportive. Now everybody is supporting Ukraine. I mean, good, you know, 70-80% population, which is great. Thank you. Amazing. But there was a time, you know, before, there was about 2 months of a very gray zone of people, especially who have big careers in music, just kind of observing how it's going to go and not really saying anything. Because they're not defending any principle, you know. Like their main priority is commerce and their career. So
a prominent front man in the metal world, who you probably know too, he's from Hungary, and he told me right after this happened, that it's crazy. They should have just let Russia walk in and saved everybody's lives.
That is the most moronic thing I ever heard.
Well, that was kind of where some people, the Biden camp, seemed to be. Okay, Zelensky, we found you some safe passage. We'll get you out of the country now. You ready? And to his eternal credit, a former TV comedy actor said no.
Yeah, they don't know Ukrainians. These people who say things like that, they just have not read the book yet. Once they read the book, at least first page of the book, and realize that, it's like saying I'm going to exaggerate a little bit, but it's basically the same. It's like saying, it's like explaining to people constantly that, Russia, that Germany is not France, It's like an equivalent. I'm exaggerating a little bit, It's like saying like, hey, why doesn't, just Germany let France walk over them? It's like, why isn't that awesome? It's like, there's a lot of reasons why that would not be.
Right, of course.
And that those people are just, they bought in into that whole mythology, which is, we all know Power of the Myth, Joseph Campbell, of course. Goebbels, they all employed it very well. Make it as blurry and as stupefying to the majority of people, they will not take time to explore. So that those myths, of course, get disseminated through the world, and some people are still operating on them, but we're undoing them. So,
well, on the other hand, our first or second of the long phone calls after Putin stormed in, you seemed weirdly relaxed and confident, we will win because we have stamina. And I'm thinking, well, I know you have stamina. My God, it's amazing, the live shows and things. But to then say the whole country is like that, and you truly believe that, don't you?
Well, it's like this. First of all, Ukrainians do have quite a massive stamina, and it's historical trait. It's probably one of the traits that one of the biggest national traits. And it's been revered by many great Ukrainian poets like Taras Shevchenko and Ivan Franko and Lesya Ukrainka. They all wrote about it. There's tons of quotes about perseverance and underdog resistance. I mean, it's almost, that's undeniable. So if you're Ukrainian, you know that. People who are not Ukrainian, they don't know that. So they'll find out. Now, this is another part of this whole confusion is, as your song says, we created Putin. So I think that, of course, as an artist, you make an exaggerated statement, but I think that you at least co-created Putin. How? By all these Hollywood ideas of greatness of Russians and all this kind of, because it sells, this whole myth that they have some kind of mighty guys, like in a Rocky IV, Ivan Drago, this unbeatable guy. It's like they don't have guys like they have guys like this in like Dagestan and Ukraine. That's where they have guys.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, my point on we created Putin was especially that there never would have been somebody, a strong man, who got in just like Hitler did after World War I if we hadn't treated the entire former Soviet Union like we treated the Germans after World War I and just pissed on everybody instead of trying to reach in and help and rebuild. It was instead of like, ha ha on you and maybe we can loot you a bit. And of course, it didn't help that George Bush the First was in charge at first, and the whole thing was, okay, how can we plunder this And in order to get people in Russia to accept this, Greg Palast, who has also been on Renegade Roundtable, we talked about who created Putin. He said, no, it wasn't just the terrible decision not to have a Marshall Plan to rebuild the former Soviet Union and prevent another Hitler or something from taking over, which has now happened. But also, there are people even back then who wanted that among all our corporate barons and the Larry Summers type economist types who are saying, no, we need to find our own Pinochet.
Right.
And Yeltsin is drinking too much. We need someone else. And helped build up Putin from the inside. That's the claim of Greg Palast, among others, that we helped create Putin that way, too.
Right.
He was our guy.
Well, of course, as an author of the song, you have wider insight into it. And thank you. I'm always up for the enlightenment. So that broadens the thing. But instantly, that's what I took out of it, is like that kind of co-creation and the mythology of it. Now that you introduced me more to the whole concept of that song, on that level, please don't underestimate that Russia has long history of dictatorship and totalitarianism. Yeah. In fact, that's the only history they have. They don't. Yeah. They never had any other history. So in that sense, creating Putin was not necessary. It was a done deal. It was going to happen. In fact, one of the big academical hits, I think I have it on the shelf here, from the 90s, it was very popular amongst my friends, was this psychoanalytical book called Slave Soul of Russia, written by a British scholar. The subtitle was Masochistic Origins of Russian Culture and Cult of Suffering, which was all about... In fact, Al Jurgensen knew this book. We were recording recently a collab, and it came up, and Al was completely on top of this game. And so we talked about it, and I kind of thought that everybody knows this book, but it's a good survey. It's about 300-400 pages of going down the foundation of their culture and how well it's conditioned into a totalitarianism and dictatorship. That's the all from Ivan the Terrible to through Peter the Great to, you know, Catherine the so-called Great and Lenin and Stalin, and now it's all like what else is fucking new, you know? So, you know, I don't know if you did have to work so hard to create Putin, what was inevitable, you know? They don't know any other way.
Is people on our side of the border, meaning not Ukraine, but Western Europe, America, whatever, looking with a stereotypical lens at the average Russian person and viewing them as somebody who drinks a lot of vodka and is always in a bad mood and just... You know, it's a miserable country, which I think we both know isn't entirely true. But it also means I wonder how true this book really is, although you and Al both seem to put a lot of weight on it. But then I wonder, too, with all the flying propaganda back and forth about this war in Ukraine, although I call it a war on Ukraine, which is, you know, it's Putin's war in Ukraine. He's making war on Ukraine, basically. You know, of course, they highlight any so-called victories of driving Putin's army or the Russian army out of this. Oh, there's all these people deserting. There's all these people who don't have food or clothes. But yet, here comes more missiles. Here comes more bombs. Are the Ukrainians really winning yet, or will they win at all? At the same time, these reports, actually, Putin just fell down some stairs and shit his pants and had to be cleaned up by his minions because he's got dying of pancreatic cancer and something else.
Yeah, there was that too, yeah.
But is that even true, or is it propaganda from our side, or even the Rupert Murdoch side that's throwing this at us and we don't really know what to believe?
Well, you know, there is a bit of leeway to, you have to be your own disinformation agent. That's the only way.
Right.
And you've done quite well on the front.
So, well, I'm not 100% right. And I hate being wrong when I'm a person other people listen to, but it does happen.
It does happen.
We all believe what we want to believe. At the end of the day, you just got to be very careful on what you want to believe.
Of course. In the same time, it comes down to what's actually happening on the battlefield.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of, you know, there is a lot of channels saying many different things just to give people big up or catharsis or, you know, anger them more or relax them a little bit. So it's informational chaos, but I think that you gotta look at what's up on the battlefield really and look at the follow basically war analysts for that's gonna be the most tangible information. So if you see that on map of Ukraine that Ukrainian army is pushing them out, that's basically what is happening. Well, let's put it this way. The tactics that Ukrainian army is exercising are changing the warfare history. It's not something that is actually predictable because they had to figure something completely else out because they're so outnumbered. Luckily, you know, Ukrainians are very savvy and street smart, and they exercised the tactics that debunked Russian attacks in the first days and continue to do so. And it makes it hard for war analysts to even analyze situation and see where the next thing is coming from. All you need to know is that there hasn't been any success on the Russian front since the beginning of war. They've been just getting their ass kicked and dying in spades. So that's like undeniable factual information, you know?
I think they call it guerrilla warfare, don't they?
There's that. It's a highly maneuverable tactical operations they're running Ukrainian army with very small parts. So with very small rapidly locating and dislocating groups.
Yeah. It's
and there's other things, of course, the drone warfare is a completely another new dimension, and that's basically became like a most crucial factor, you know. So they're doing
some of this right down to the strength and the stamina reminds me of Ho Chi Minh driving the French out and then even driving the Americans out of the southern part of the country, his own army in the Viet Cong.
The thing is that another factor nobody can ever underestimate is that Ukrainians are home. Their motivation is in their bone marrow. You can't fight that motivation, as Russian motivation doesn't exist. And first of all, they're Mamluks. They're slave soldiers. They don't even care what the cause is. They don't know what the cause is. They just think that that's a good enough cause as they were told to do certain thing. That's their psychology. And it's a very different psychology from Ukrainians, you know, who have a great history of, Kazakhdom, which was a warrior class state, and anarchism, you know, Nestor Makhno, you know, being from a practitioner of anarchy community. You know about that, I'm sure.
Actually, not at all, which means a lot of the listeners don't either.
Oh, well, Nestor Makhno was a huge anarchist, theoretician, and practical guy who had created a commune, a quite well-functioning anarchist commune in early years of after the revolution. He kind of basically squatted chunk of land in Ukraine, and they had an educational program and kind of like a anarcho-syndicalist commune that was kind of greatly revered by many. Then he was, of course, betrayed and stabbed in the back by the Red Army of Bolsheviks came and destroyed the whole thing, and he died in exile.
Okay, so it was after that revolution. Okay, yeah. After the... So, that's real interesting. Wow.
Yeah, he died in France. I think his last writings were in Strasbourg, and I have all of his books. And so it's a place of people with a very different psychology, who are gonna always fight for defining their vector and their destiny. You know, they're not interested in anybody telling them what the fuck to do. These are just not those people. And you're looking at it now, you know. That's where all that stamina and all that wits and admirable energy is coming from. It's from that history.
I was almost afraid to ask, but I'll do it now instead of earlier. You mentioned you've been checking up on your family and your friends.
Yeah.
Have you lost anybody?
You know, thank you for asking. Luckily, everybody's okay.
That's good.
Yeah, and they are in Kyiv.
Did you actually play in Kyiv on your last tour? You got in and out of Ukraine in spite of Putin's army?
Well, no, we went specifically to play in Ukraine in August.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we made specific trip. It was organized together with our friends, and we played on military bases and military base and refugee hubs. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, it was a very kind of a necessary thing to do, just for a lot of reasons, just kind of break that idea that Ukraine is a place where is off the limits. It's not off the limits. I mean, you know, the semantics play tricks on people all the time. You know, every time you open the newspaper here on the radio, when Russia invaded Ukraine, it's like Russia never invaded Ukraine. If you look at the map, the Russia is like around the border with Russia, there is a bit of occupied territory, which is shrinking every day. But, you know, 90% of Ukrainian territory was never invaded. So it's a bit like dawning on people. It gets into their head that Russia is everywhere in Ukraine. It's like, no, there's people in Ukraine who are continuing with their life despite warfare, you know?
Well, the lesson, I guess, for me and many others is when they flash on a map on the news of Ukraine showing where the stuff's going on and the different colors for what Russia is occupying and this, that, and the other, I haven't looked as carefully as I could. I just assume it's a map of the whole country.
Yeah.
Now that I think about it, perhaps it is not a map of the whole country, but maybe, I don't know, the northeastern part or the northeastern third, maybe, or, you know, or where the Donbass is. And
that's the most problematic area, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, and to come to think of it, yeah, there are ones where I don't even see Kyiv on the map, let alone Odessa or points west, because it's not a map of the whole country. And so this part that a lot of Ukraine isn't even invaded, that's very, very interesting. I did not know that, and I'm not sure how many other people did.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are basically, I mean, there are air raids. I mean, there was air raid when we were there, but people pretty much, if they're not in a territory of extreme warfare, I mean, there's still missile strikes, but people continue with their lives. It's it's hard to explain. You can't call it a normal life, but people do have psychological tools, I mean, inborn, to get adapted and kind of persevere through these things. And especially in Ukraine, that has everybody who grew up there, well, with my generation probably being the last generation, and now again it starts, has grandparents, you know, wounded and from the war. It's like, it was an uncommon thing.
Yeah.
Like everybody's grandparents, probably 85% of people's grandparents were at war and were wounded, or something happened with them that, you know, some kind of PTSD. So
yeah, PTSD was not acknowledged until maybe Vietnam or after Vietnam.
Right.
My dad was in Korea in the early 50s, sent there against his will, and he turned out to be a psychiatric medic in a real MASH hospital, which,
wow,
of course, was much more blood-soaked horror than the one you ever saw on TV.
Oh, my God.
And he told me it was about people hearing gunshots that weren't really there and flashbacks, and now they call it PTSD. And occasionally, you'd even have a North Korean soldier wander into camp. They tried to help and stuff. And one superior officer once all of a sudden flipped out and thought he was a cat and climbed up a tree and wouldn't get down. And finally, they put a bowl of milk at the base of the tree and he came down. But now it's PTSD, but a lot of people from all over, any place that was just wrecked and bombed and everything else in World War II, let alone the later Balkan Wars, there's PTSD untreated, unacknowledged, all over the place, and obviously handled a different way, and the stories and whatever they want to say, if anything, is passed down from your grandparents to your parents and then down to you, and kind of treated a different way.
Wow.
I guess. And then, of course, there's, you know, I guess it has been lifted now. Gino Yabjevich from Culture Shock, who's going to be on Renegade Roundtable real soon.
I love Gino, man.
You first, but yeah, he's going to talk about really being in a war stuff and not being able to hang out in New York the whole time and stuff. Not yet anyway, but now he's in Seattle. But anyway,
what a great band.
Yo, I know. Soon to be on Alternative Tentacles. The 7-inch just arrived, and one of the albums is coming next. Yes. So watch out, everybody, for Gino Yevgenovich. What a, like Eugene, what a character, too, and mountain of stories. But Billy Gould, you know, the Faith No More guy who had Cool Arrow Records,
yes, yes,
putting out Culture Shock, Gino's band that we're doing in the earlier days, he told me that the European Union was not letting anybody with a Bosnian passport into the rest of the EU because they were afraid they would come to visit and never leave, and every damn one of them had serious PTSD going on, and they didn't want to have to deal with it in the EU, which, you know, is not exactly the most empathetic approach. Gino told me in the last month or so that is no longer the case, and Bosnians can travel now. But again, you know, new frontiers of PTSD everywhere you look. But
wow,
for, you know, everybody from me to people listening to this and other people, everybody knows, what is the best thing, or what can we as individuals and collectively over here do to help the people in Ukraine? What can we do?
Well, stay with us as far as understanding of what we're doing, that this is not, stay with the idea that, get to the core of idea, first of all. Like, it should not be a mythological area where, like, people are still figuring out who the good guys is. It's just like that whole, like, Macron rhetoric is retarded. Like, you know, that France, right, is still, like, trying to decide, like, where is their place in this fight. Like, that is absolutely, I mean, of course, he's probably, whatever, saying what he's been told to say by somebody. But yeah, if you're a person who doesn't have that situation, yeah, it's important to understand where the, as they say, from where the legs are growing. And the legs are growing from the fact that Ukraine is doing something very basic and undeniable. And it's going to win, but we do and welcome and need all the support that can be provided so it can be won faster. Winning it faster is really what it's about, because people, you know, the people who go fight in Ukraine, these are not people who are, like, you know, waste cases like they draw in Russia. Because most of Russia is basically, like, that all those terrible, depressed territories where, like, level of life is non-existent. You know, they draw people from there and, you know, push them into the warfare with zero motivation and zero idea what they're doing. But their number is large. But in Ukraine, people who go to the war are people who really are there for motivated right reasons, and a lot of times these are, like, the most advanced people of the nation. Like, people, like, I just read the guy who was, like, a, you know, the star of ballet died on the front line, you know, like,
oh,
you know, just people, like, sort who are so far away from that walk of life, who sign up for it and go. And that's where that, the, yeah, filmmakers, directors, writers, poets, you know, just like, I mean, everybody's life is precious, but I'm talking about the faster it can stop.
Right.
That's what we're really talking about.
But also when you talk about winning, I mean, what do you define even as winning now? There's all these cities just bombed out and leveled, bridges destroyed, millions of homeless refugees. You get the place back. And this goes for Putin, too, if he actually did seize part of it. Once you've got all this destroyed stuff, what have you got? What have you actually won?
He is not, I mean, that is completely irrational. There is no logic behind that whole situation. It's deeply irrational behavior of the whole country. But let them live with that. The purpose of Ukraine is get everybody off the territory and reestablish sovereignty. Let's call it for that day a win. Because that will be an amazing lesson to that maniacal ill neighbor, and a message for 100 years to come to never fuck this way. And that will be a victory, because the amount of people and businesses that will want to go to Ukraine to rebuild, the line is around the block already.
Right.
That will not be a problem.
We can only hope. We can only hope.
That will not be a problem.
In the meantime, should we be trying to gather up things like ski jackets and sleeping bags?
Yes.
Super warm after ski boots to help people who are in danger of freezing to death over the winter?
Absolutely. Actually, I was going to say this.
Who's collecting them? Who's going to get them there? Well, or do you know yet?
That's kind of what I was getting at. Is I was trying to get to this, that humanitarian help is kind of word that gets thrown around a lot. Almost people get desensitized to it, like whatever that means. But that means exactly that. It's just the winter is here and winter is there, and warfare. And just being my friends, civilians, with, you know, living in Kiev, but, you know, the electricity and heat cuts out. People have like 2-3 children, you know. You know, people are like burning wood in an apartment, you know, with like self-made chimney out of the window. Like, it's so, we, you know, we collect money buying generators, sending stuff like that over. So anything really, clothes, generators, medical supplies, right. All of that is gold right now.
But where can it be sent?
Well, there are organizations that are very reliable, like Razum for Ukraine, which is friends of mine, actually, and Razum, Razom.4.Ukraine. You know, that's a very reliable.
You said R-A-Z is in Z-O-M.
Yeah.
.for.Ukraine.
Yeah, Razum. Yeah.
Is there a .com or a .org after that?
I think it's .org. I'm not sure, but Razum for Ukraine is the organization. I mean, they're as accessible as Instagram.
Yeah, and send us a little link and we'll get it around.
Yes, Razom.
Yeah.
So
send us a link and we'll get it around.
They've been a very reliable.
Tick, tick. Clock is about to strike 12 when we turn into pumpkins.
Yes.
Well, I don't think... easily destroyed by Russian ordnance. So really good to talk to you, and hope we talk again soon.
Yeah, I don't think we ever had a conversation less than 2 hours with you.
Not quite. We're hitting on 2 hours, but then down the line, another phone call. We shall see. And take care and best wishes to your family and your colleagues over here. And
thank you so much. Thank you so much, Jill. Thank you for having me.
Au revoir, everybody. Away I go.
Much respect for all you do.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.